Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a response to President Obama's recent remarks on race and a reaction to the demonstrations taking place across the country in response to the verdict acquitting George Zimmerman for shooting the unarmed black teenager Trayvon Martin. Charles Gallagher, a professor of sociology and the chair of the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice at La Salle University, and author of Below the Belt, Race, Ethnicity, Labor, and Politics in a Changing Sunbelt, joins us to discuss why a lot of whites cling to the fiction that race relations are no longer a problem in America. Then we will speak with Aubrey Hendricks, a visiting scholar in religion and African American studies at Columbia University and author of The Universe Bends Towards Justice, Radical Reflections on the Bible, the Church, and the Body Politic. We will discuss how the president might build on his powerful speeches on race that many feel do not go sufficiently beyond rhetoric, to address the reality of race relations in America, brought into focus by the flagrantly unjust killing of Trayvon Martin and the acquittal of his killer. Then finally, we'll go to Israel to speak with Gideon Levy, who is a columnist for Haaretz and the author of The Punishment of Gaza. His recent article, The Israeli Patriots' Final Refuge Boycott, has gained international attention and might have broken the law in Israel. With peace talks between Israel and Palestine resuming tentatively and reluctantly, we will discuss Gideon Levy's contention that change won't come from within unless Israel pays a price for the occupation. And joining us now is Charles Gallagher, who is a professor of sociology and a chair of the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice at La Salle University. He's the editor and co-editor, respectively, of two new books, New Directions in Race Research and Below the Belt, Race, Ethnicity, Labor, and Politics in a Changing Sunbelt. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Gallagher.
Pleasure to be here, and thank you.
And I guess if Florida is a part of the Sunbelt, it's not changing enough, right?
No, it's not.
Maybe it's changing in the wrong direction with these, stand your ground laws as well.
Well, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, there has been changes, and if you look at the polling data, and the polling data has moved monotonically. That is, it is in one direction, and the direction tends to be towards greater tolerance. But I think polling data covers over larger structural issues. I think it's easy in polling data to say that you wouldn't mind working with someone that was black. It's very different in terms of how people really live out their lives, where they live, where they send their kids to school. If you happen to have a son or daughter and they bring someone home across the color line, what that means for the family dynamics. So, I mean, I think that the president's talk was, a week in coming. And obviously, he waited a week until he finally went up to the podium to talk about Trayvon Martin, which I think is a tad long. And quite honestly, I thought that his presentation was quite heartfelt, but I thought that it was a tad anemic. And I think certainly that as the president, as a black man, he experienced these things. But once again, President Barack Obama was in front of the American population, and he did not talk about what needs to be done. And that conversation has yet to happen.
Well, do we know what needs to be done? I mean, what do you believe needs to be done?
Well, I mean, I think what should have happened over the last, since his second term, is that he could very easily have pointed out the ways in which institutional racism is still very much embedded in American life, political life. And this, again, this is where social science comes in. This is not about opinion. It is very easy to look at lots of sociologists doing very good work, and anything from stop and frisk. I mean, it's a very good example. The state of New York is being sued basically because it's a violation of black and brown civil rights. But the larger point is that if you look at who does drugs in the United States, whites and blacks do drugs at the same rate. And if you were to come into my neighborhood, which is a first-rung suburb of Philadelphia, it's white, it's affluent, and you started pulling kids over randomly, whites between the ages of 18 and 30, you would absolutely find marijuana, you'd find Ritalin, you'd find ecstasy, you'd find drugs. But we don't police out here. We don't stop people. We don't stop someone that's white, driving that's 20 years old and basically do a pat down. If we did, we'd have white middle class kids filling the jails. That would never happen because white middle class America would never let it happen. So I mean, just stop and frisk is just one example. We could talk about schooling. We could talk about wealth disparities between blacks and white. We could have access to health care. All these things are structural. And the problem with color blindness today, and whites are very invested in the colorblind narrative, is that if you say that we're now colorblind, a few things happen. If you don't make it, you can blame the person, right? So if someone doesn't become president or the CEO or can't get a job, you don't say that it's systemic discrimination. You say there's something wrong with the individual or there's something pathological about the culture of those people. And the second thing that colorblindness does for whites, it means that if you say the playing field is level, it means there's no such thing as white privilege. So it erases the notion that somehow being white in the United States is a benefit. So there's a lot of ideological work going on. And the president has, quite honestly, I mean, if you remember a while ago, the Henry Louis Gates affair, where he had a beer. He met with a cop that arrested the Harvard professor. He actually had a beer summit, and he got in trouble for it. And he got a little burned from that, and he basically, after that, never discussed race again. And in this situation, he had to because of the riots. I mean, he waited a week, quite honestly, to get ahead of this and to discuss the matter. So, I mean, the one thing a president should do is use the bully pulpit, and he has not done that.
Well, but he did, surely he did that on Friday. I mean, and demonstrations have taken place over this weekend. It's not like this issue is going away. And he did also mention in his speech the criminal justice system and how blacks are disproportionately involved in the criminal justice system. And then in black neighborhoods, there is a lot of black on black crime. He did at least address all of these issues, and I guess the question now is, what is the follow-up? And again, what do you think is the follow-up or should be the follow-up?
Well, I think it's interesting that you can't point to something the president said about a follow-up. What he said was, I thought, was interesting because the words matter. He thought it was more appropriate that people talk about these issues in the small places, in the small places of your family, of your church. And, you know, what that's really saying is that he doesn't want, I mean, you could think about what LBJ did. I mean, LBJ took what Kennedy started with civil rights agenda, and he passed through some of the most radical civil rights legislation in American history. And this was a man that had a history, LBJ, of engaging in really racist behaviors. And he came to a kind of, I guess, a moral epiphany, and he said, you know, this is what we got to do. As he said, we've lost the South forever. And that is, this president, LBJ, was willing to basically say, okay, I'm going to do the right thing. I don't see from the president, there are lots of things one could do. One could bring in federal enforcement. One could toughen laws. The president could do many things. He didn't outline one thing, not one, in his speech.
Well, he specifically said that this is something that he doesn't feel politicians can handle.
Well, I mean, so then he's just basically passing the ball to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
What is the role of the federal government when it comes to guaranteeing the rights of citizens? Trayvon Martin's rights, what I really believe, it's another indication that the rule of law doesn't apply equally to everyone. That is, that if in the rule of law, if everyone is expected to be treated equally in the eyes of the law, it's just not the case for most blacks in the United States. So, I mean, there's if you wanted to start to enforce things, you could, and you could use the feds to do it. But again, I don't think if the president talks about race, I mean, here's the problem. The way that color blindness works now, that if you even talk about race, it means you're a racist. Because if people believe that the color line has been erased and that the playing field is now level, the people that are bringing up race are either race baiters or they're making their living through it, you know, and so that's the dilemma. This is this kind of catch-22, is that people don't want to talk about race because they say we don't need to talk about race any longer because our parents took care of that stuff during the civil rights era. So this is the kind of, this is where we happen to be. And I teach, you know, 18 and 19 year olds. They believe, they honestly believe that the playing field is level, in part because they watch television, and television is filled with multiracial cast of characters in different shows. And they see folks on television, and they think, well, you know, they're represented, and they look good, and they're driving a nice car, and they're getting a girl or getting a boy. So the reality that people construct for most white Americans is not because they have best friends that are across the color line or because they live in integrated neighborhoods. It's because they watch television. And a generation, you know, if you're 20 or below, you've been weaned on a diet of shows that show people drinking beer, eating pizza, sleeping together. So my 18-year-olds, and these kids are bright at LaSalle, they come in, and I have to work just to get them to see that there is still racial inequality. And, of course, I pull out the numbers. You can look at incarceration, graduation of high school rates, who goes to jail, all these things, who has access to medical care, the dime on the dollar of wealth disparities. I mean, so there are many ways that sociologists can point at to disparities which reflect really institutional processes. The problem is 18-year-olds come to my class and they think that everyone has equal opportunity. And that's the biggest fight I had, is saying, whoa, let's back up. So here's the problem. How do you have a conversation about something where people feel there isn't a problem?
Well, again, I'm speaking with Charles Gallagher, who's a professor of sociology and the chair of the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice at LaSalle University. He's the editor and co-editor, respectively, of two books, New Directions in Race Research and Below the Belt, Race, Ethnicity, Labor, and Politics in a Changing Sun Belt. Well, clearly, a lot of people, not just the Sean Hannitys of this world, who made some outrageous remarks in response to the president's remarks on race the other day. The Supreme Court recently ruled against the Voting Rights Act. You know, basically gutted the core of the Voting Rights Act because they contend that we don't have a problem anymore, which is right. Which is this comfortable white narrative. What do you think is the psychological underpinning of that white narrative? Is it because if you believe this, that you no longer have to be guilty about the extraordinary history of repression of African Americans in this country that the country in effect fought a civil war over, and then when the slaves were freed, they were then re-imprisoned by Jim Crow, and it was only until, as you mentioned, the 1965 Voting Rights Act, the very act that the Supreme Court recently struck down, that Lyndon Johnson realized that he would do the right thing, but he would lose the South. And now, of course, we know the Republican Party has become a Southern party.
Well, I think it's very interesting to me that you know, someone like Hannity, the comments he made that it could have been, I mean, it was really despicable, his comments. You know, I mean, I think there's a few things that, I think part of the disrespect that is directed at the president is because he's black. No right-wing talk show person spoke that way about Clinton, really, for the most, but I guess some people.
What about George W. Bush, though? The left piled on relentlessly about what an idiot and a joke he was, and a jerk.
Yeah, I mean, but you know,
I did it myself, I must confess.
Right, I know the gaffes were real, the things that he said. Saying that the president is like Trayvon Martin because he smokes marijuana and does lines of cocaine is really, I mean, that is not someone, you know, hacking up a word or misstating where a country was. It's very different. But I think also what Hannity was really getting at, if you don't like the message, attack the messenger. And what that is it's very smart distraction. You know, so he doesn't really have to talk about what is the real issue here. And that, let's be honest, the real issue here is that for many white Americans, Trayvon Martin was in fact a criminal until he could prove otherwise. And this is, if you look at how people think about stereotypes, the fact is that Trayvon Martin in the imagination of many whites in the United States, is guilty until he can demonstrate through body language or dress or the way he presents himself that he's not a criminal. So there's that going on. And I think it's interesting also that the first thing that happened after the Voting Rights Bill was basically trashed, Texas, Florida, Georgia, they put in place immediately provisions that required people to have multiple forms of ID, and well knowing that certain groups are going to be disenfranchised. And who are they? They're the elderly, and they're people of color, and the poor. So, I mean, this is literally the day, I mean, someone actually did how many hours it took before these states put in full force the need to basically have greater forms of identification. And it's a way to disenfranchise people. So, I mean, you know, and these are states that historically, there's a reason why the feds required them to do this. These were places that basically constantly created mechanisms to make sure that these groups could not vote. So, you know, this is, again, it's cynical. These things are so horribly cynical. And, you know, who is calling out these folks? You know, and you know, to top it off, it's hilarious to read, you know, Clarence Thomas's opinions on these things. You know, here's a man who would benefit enormously from affirmative action, would never have found himself in the situation he is now, but he wants to pull up the rope for other people that basically might be able to grab a hand onto it and move themselves up and out.
Well, we've had a similar African-American fellow called Ward Connolly here who brought about, on the basis of what they call reverse discrimination, basically ended the University of California's requirements in terms of giving you know, minority students access to education here in California. And since this idea that we have reverse discrimination, that somehow the whites are an oppressed minority in this country, the University of California's enrollment of particularly of African American Latinos has just gone down.
Yeah,
I mean, we know the results. So you have this extraordinary rhetoric on one side. Do they believe it, or they're just incredibly cynical, these people?
Well, I think it's a combination. You know, I mean, if you really want to make a name for yourself quickly and you're African American, then toe the most reactionary right wing line you can basically do. You know, if it's Shelby Steele, if it's, you know, and again, I find that some of these people are just hacks. But I think that, and I don't want to say self-loathing, but I think a lot of folks believe that, and I believe these folks are delusional, that they really believe that the color line should never matter. And, you know, quite honestly, Ian, I would also like to be in that camp. I would like to live in a colorblind world where maybe the only thing that color represented was culture, people's different backgrounds. But, you know, I'm a realist. I'm also a social scientist. And, you know, it's hard for me. The research I'm doing now, I'm looking at what do whites believe? And what I've come to my own conclusion after interviewing whites all over the country and studying racial attitudes for two decades is that there is a big slice of white America. They're not racist like the way we think about Jim Crow racism or biological racism. These folks, you know, they may harbor stereotypes, as we all do because we're human. But there's a big slice of white America that honestly, truly believes that the playing field is level. We live in a post-race, post-civil rights country where racial discrimination is no longer a problem.
And we have a black president.
Exactly. And again, Exhibit A is Barack Obama. And, right. And on top of that, and this starts to get into basically how whites see themselves now as victims, on top of that, you have a majority of whites, some 53%, now believe that discrimination against whites is as bad as discrimination, but that is, it is as frequent. So, and I'm thinking, you know, it's like, who are these folks? I mean, I don't know. I know lots of white people, but I don't hear any of my white friends saying that a cop pulled them over constantly or they got stopped three times. I mean, I just don't know. Now, maybe there's age discrimination, which, of course, does happen in the labor market. But the idea that whites now position themselves as being a victim in this kind of world of race consciousness, to me is shocking, and it's, again, it's not borne out by the statistics at all.
Well, Charles Gallagher, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Charles Gallagher, who's a professor of sociology and chair of the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice at La Salle University. He's the editor and co-editor, respectively, of two new books, New Directions in Race Research and Below the Belt, Race, Ethnicity, Labor, and Politics. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with a visiting scholar in religion and African-American studies at Columbia University.
Because a few of them were white, and it's the same across the nation. Black and white discrimination, yeah, and you can't understand me, and all that other jazz they hand me in the papers and TV, and all that mass stupidity that seems to grow more every day. Each time you hear something we'd say, you want to go and do your in, cause the color of your skin just don't appeal to him, no matter if it's black or white, because he's out for blood tonight.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Aubrey Hendricks, who is a visiting scholar in religion and African American studies at Columbia University and professor of biblical interpretation at New York's Theological Seminary. He is the author of The Politics of Jesus, Rediscovering the True Revolutionary Nature of Jesus' Teaching and How They Have Been Corrupted. And his latest book is The Universe Bends Towards Justice, Radical Reflections on the Bible, the Church, and the Body Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aubrey Hendricks.
That's my pleasure. My pleasure.
And Aubrey, I'd like to talk about how the president might build on his powerful speeches on race that many feel do not go sufficiently beyond rhetoric to address the reality of the race relations in America brought into focus by the flagrantly unjust killing of Trayvon Martin and the acquittal of his killer. I take it you also share the feeling that we've got to go beyond rhetoric.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and I don't want to say that it's just rhetoric. I think that he made some powerful points. He took an important step in helping America to see, mostly white America to see, to understand what the real issue is and what the suffering, how deep the suffering goes and why there's such outrage. So it's always important to have, to try to facilitate dialogue by, you know, by helping mutual understanding. Except, you know, there wasn't really much mutual understanding, you know, being shot for here, I think, because he was speaking to white people. Didn't have a lot to say to black people. But, you know, I'm of two minds. I guess what I find a little discomforting is that he did not really take a moral position. You know, he tried to, you know, to share both sides of the story, and you know, he didn't make any strong commitment. Like Lyndon Johnson said, we are going to conquer poverty. You know. He came down hard like that. Now, I know it's harder for a black president to say that he's going to do something that that benefits his group. I mean, Lyndon Johnson had the benefit of being seen as being, having a disinterested interest in the welfare of poor and the black people. But the president, I think, has to, he could have been more effective by taking a moral position about how wrong this treatment is and how it has stopped. You know, he's the president of all Americans, and there are tens of millions of Americans who face all kinds of obstacles they shouldn't every day. And he can say that, look, I'm the president of all Americans. That includes black Americans. You know, I'm fighting for gay people and obstacles be removed from them, disabled people, women. You know, and black people have obstacles, too, that that are un-American, and we're going to address all of them. But he never says it like that, you know. He never shares it with great moral conviction and passion.
Well, Aubrey Hendricks, it does seem that the president is caught between absolutely vicious and venal hatred on the right and a lot of disappointment on the left, and that in many ways, he's damned if he does and damned if he doesn't in terms of bringing up race relations and the color of his skin because, for example, a lot of progressives want him to be more tough. They want him to get out there and fight. And I imagine in many ways he's restrained from that because he doesn't want to come across as an angry black man. So yeah. To what extent do you think he is circumscribed by the – I mean, maybe you're right, though. Maybe he should step out and it would be more effective. But do you at least acknowledge the reasons for this apparent caution on his part?
Well, yeah, I do understand. I really do. I mean, he's facing the kind of assault and obstructionism that no other president has ever face, and there's and it's really colored by a homicidal hatred in many quarters, of going beyond anything that's ever been seen. But you know, as we know, those who hate him are going to continue hating him anyway. I mean, he's not going to stop being black, and they're not going to. There's nothing he can do to satisfy them, and because he's made up his mind, they've made up their mind. And so I don't think that should go into his deliberations. I mean, we don't know what kind of other kinds of pressures he has, you know, legislative and all that. But I mean, at a certain point, you have to take a stand and say, look, part of this problem is that the unemployment rate among African Americans is so high, unconscionably high, not because everyone's lazy, but because, you know, they're the last hired, first fired, and on down the line. You know, don't have the same educational opportunities, and then you have the profiling thing, which gets a lot of young people in the criminal justice system who don't necessarily belong there, and they come out, you know, they're tainted. So, I mean, all these things are very, very important. It's not just that. I mean, he can address these kinds of things, even in the midst of all the hell that he's catching, because he's going to catch it anyway. And you know, it's like. He you can't be middle of the ground all of the time. I mean, at this point, I think that many of his supporters, black and white, would be very much hardened if he would say, "Look, we just can't have this. We can't have any section of our citizenry mistreated." And I'm going to stand up as president, and I'm going to take a moral stand, like just as I've done here, there, elsewhere. That's how I see it.
Again, I'm speaking with Aubrey Hendricks, who's a visiting scholar in religion and African American studies at Columbia University and professor of biblical interpretation at New York Theological Seminary. He's the author of The Politics of Jesus, Rediscovering the True Revolutionary Nature of Jesus' Teachings and How They Have Been Corrupted. And his latest book is The Universe Bends Towards Justice, Radical Reflections on the Bible, the Church, and the Body Politic. Now, in terms of the church and obviously moral leadership, has resulted in extraordinary things. I mean, after all, the emancipation movement came out of the churches, and of course, one of the great teachings of the Bible is essentially empathy, to do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And I, as a white American, I was very, very moved by what the president was talking about in terms of his black experience of being followed in department stores by security people and crossing the street and hearing the locks clicking. To me, that is, you know, I thought that was a very, very good teachable moment for white Americans, and I think it struck a chord. So maybe, you know, on the one hand, as an African American, you're disappointed, but as a white American, I'm not.
Yeah, what's a good point? And let me just back up and say this: I don't have an issue with what he said. Like I said at the outset, he said some important things that have never been said before from that bully pulpit. And I think it's a great step that he has taken. But I was not as comfortable with the way that he ended the speech. In a sense, saying, "Well, there's not much that I can do as president." Well, you know, there is. I mean, if all else fails, they are executive orders, you know. But don't, you know. So he did well by spreading the responsibility, you know, among all American citizens. But he sort of poo-pooed his power to intervene. That's what makes me uncomfortable. But, you know, to hear. Any man, stand up to talk about the painful plight of African Americans every day. I mean, this is still a white supremacist society. White folks have, you know, have privileges I don't have. I mean, clearly, you know. I mean, one privilege is an easy privilege. You can walk in the store and not be an instant suspect.
Sure.
You know? And I knew a judge. I had a friend who was a judge. Who was arrested for shoplifting and hadn't done a thing, and detained overnight. Never would have done that to a white man or a white judge. So, I mean, so you see, it's obvious I'm of mixed emotions, but I guess I'll come down on this. I would rather he gave this speech than not. And I'm thrilled that he gave it. I just want to trust that this is a beginning step for him, and that he chooses to go further.
Well, but the Trayvon Martin Zimmerman situation really brings into light what you just said, that there's a double standard and a deadly double standard in this case. There's a lot more that could have been said, I think. I mean, beyond empathy, there should be some outrage, don't you think?
Yeah. I mean, it's, as far as the president's showing outrage, I think that's dicey. I also think, though, it can have a power. I look at presidents who've erupted with righteous indignation, and that empowers those who support him and those whose outrage he shares. Also, those are greatly teachable moments. Righteous indignation raises a lot of questions, and it wakes people up sometimes. But for him to do that, I mean, look, they call him the racist in chief because he said that black people have had these experiences. Imagine if he,
right.
if he came out and said, you know, what I'm feeling, you know. The Trayvon Martin thing was that, I mean, the Zimmerman verdict, and the way that we saw a young man, a young boy, who was murdered, and then he was tried for his own murder and found guilty, essentially, because he's a thug, you know, though he has no record or anything like that. Though Zimmerman does have a record of arrests, you know, for violence. But he had these people calling him a thug, and he attacked first, and he should have left him alone. He shouldn't have jumped on Zimmerman. Well, no one was there.
Right.
And why do they take Zimmerman's word for it? Zimmerman's a grown man, and you mean that 158-pound boy, he had to kill him to get him off of him? And who said who could say that Trayvon wasn't on his back first?
Right.
Or that he wasn't hit first, and that they were, I mean, who can say that?
Well, the entire narrative, of course, is what they built, and as you rightly point out, there was no evidence, there were no witnesses. It is a narrative. It's not the truth, and frankly, it's a narrative that's very comfortable for white people.
Yeah, and we see that now. What the president might have said, I'm saying what he might have said was, you know. This, he came close, that this is just unacceptable. Too many young black men are penalized, are demonized, and are in the criminal justice system, some for no fault of their own. And that this has to stop now. We must take whatever steps as a society that we can to stop this now. But he, you know, didn't do that. He just said, you know, he understands, and I want you white people to understand what we're going through, which is important, but it's not enough because, I mean, what steps is he talking about? You know, let's talk to the police so they can have better understanding and this and that. Well, that's been going on forever.
Right.
So, that's nothing new.
Well, a lot of people, of course, you know, criticize the president in the sense that he doesn't have a traditional African American background. His father was from Africa, and his mother from Kansas, and he grew up in Hawaii and Indonesia, and he had to sort of learn his African American cultural and social history on his own. And I guess what connected him to the black experience is simply that he is black. But he's married to a black woman. That's his universe, his family.
Right.
He talks about his wife and his family. I've met him a couple of times and with his wife, and he's, you know, there's a very, very powerful bond there. I mean, he has found his place as an African American. I think anybody has a right to question his blackness anymore.
Oh, no, not at all. And I give him a lot of credit. A lot of people do not keep in mind, and I myself have to catch myself, have to remember, yes, he did not grow up with the day-to-day horror that I grew up. I was stopped by the Klan when I was 10 years old. I mean, I've been, man, I can't begin to tell you how often I faced harm and suffered harm and faced death at the hands of angry whites just for being black. He didn't grow up experiencing that, and that's no, so he can't really understand the depth of the suffering. I think he does, you know, he does as well as he can. He does very well. I'm saying that to say, though, that folk cannot, we have to be careful not to try to hold him to the standard of someone who really has experienced these things and say, well, he's not saying, you know, he should be, you know, more one way and more the other way. I mean, we have to give him some room and some credit, you know, for the fact that he chooses to identify as he does, you know, with the pain of people, the pain that he himself has not suffered. And that's why I think I want to put my remarks in context. I've always been a supporter of Barack Obama, and I still am. I worked in this campaign from the first day that Joshua Du Bois, his religion advisor, came on. I was working with Joshua from the beginning, and I support President Obama, you know, very strongly. But part of my support, and there's not enough going on in the black community, I think, is to share my concerns. I mean, as a patriot, as an American, I have that responsibility. So I'm not against President Obama. I want him to succeed, but I also want him to hear, you know, all sides of the story. And this is an important side of the story, I think.
Well, he just in terms of some optimism here, he did talk about his children, and I have a millennial daughter, and there's no question that the younger kids today are infinitely more post-racial than we are, and obviously this Trayvon Martin Zimmerman case has indicated that there's a kind of delusional white comfort zone out there that people want to believe that race relations have been fixed, that it's no longer a problem in America. One of our the guests that was on before you, the criminologist and sociologist, mentioned that in many ways, I'm talking to you from Hollywood, right across the street from Universal Studios, Aubrey, and he was critical of Hollywood, in effect, for creating this kind of delusion by showing, you know, African Americans and all minorities in all of these sitcoms and everything that you see on television, et cetera, that paints a picture that reinforces this idea that it's all been fixed. Would you agree with that?
Well, yeah. I think there are a lot of factors that play into the fiction that we are a post-racial society. But I think what really is the major factor here is that white America looks for any reason to not face its culpability in the current social situation. An example, I keep talking about the high rate of criminality among young black men. What they don't talk about is that young black men are arrested at a rate that's many times whites for similar infractions or non-infractions. The conviction rate is higher, but that's ignored.
Sure.
You bring that up, you say, "Oh, you're making excuses." Well, but you have to look at the system. Is not a just system. That's not
right.
That's not an excuse.
Exactly. Well, the previous guest was saying lives in an affluent white suburb of Philadelphia, and he said the police do not arrest white kids for the drugs that they carry because they consume as many drugs, if not more, than African American kids. So, the double standard is absolutely clear, and you know,
so Hollywood plays. I mean, Hollywood reflects that.
Right.
On the other hand, you know, Hollywood has played a role showing the humanity to a lesser extent, but showing the humanity of African Americans too. You know, but Hollywood still shows us as buffoons. Also, not in blackface with big flap floppy shows, but many of that shows as buffoons. But you know, then again, maybe that's a sign that we've arrived to a certain extent.
Well, Aubrey, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I really appreciate you joining us here today.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you so much, and I appreciate your work very much.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Obrey Hendricks, who's a visiting scholar in religion and African-American studies at Columbia University and professor of biblical interpretation at New York Theological Seminary. He's the author of The Politics of Jesus, Rediscovering the True Revolutionary Nature of Jesus' Teachings and How They Have Been Corrupted. And his latest book is The Universe Bends Towards Justice, Radical Reflections on the Bible and the Church and Body Politic. And we're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with Gideon Levy about his contention that change won't come from within unless Israel pays a price for the occupation.
New absence in the mother's arms, even the warmth of a mother's arms could not keep a son from harm. Standing where the gun was drawn, overcome, done and done, he gone.
Murder.
Shell shell like a bell and run, the blood burst, body temperature fell and plunged, and in the time it took the medics to come, the breath eased out of his lungs.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Israel is Gideon Levy, who is an Israeli journalist and columnist for Haaretz and a member of the newspaper's editorial board. He is the former spokesperson for Shimon Peres, and Gideon Levy writes the weekly Twilight Zone feature, which covers the Israeli occupation in the West Bank and Gaza over the last 25 years. His latest book is The Punishment of Gaza. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gideon Levy.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And your article recently has gotten international attention, and I imagine at home it's created quite a stir. The Israeli Patriots' Final Refuge Boycott. You're suggesting here that change won't come from within in Israel, and therefore it has to come from the outside. And as long as Israelis don't pay a price for the occupation, or at least don't make the connection between cause and effect, they have no incentive to bring it to an end. So what's your reaction to Secretary of State Kerry's efforts now, indicating that there may be, well, there are going to be talks between the Israelis and the Palestinians? Is that anything that gives you hope?
It gives me some small hope, but it's just the beginning. I can just tell you that even this step was influenced one way or the other, slightly so, by the decision of the European community to, not really boycott, but to declare that all the products from the West Bank, from the settlement, will not be sold in Europe. Even this very, very administrative small step, I think, had some influence in pushing Netanyahu into the negotiation table. So things are connected.
So how much are the Israeli political elite? They must be conscious of the fact that Israel used to have enormous support in Europe. France and other countries were very close allies early in Israel's beginning through the 1960s. And then in the 1970s, with the occupation, essentially Israel has lost Europe. And I imagine Israel is concerned that eventually it may lose American affection. So how much is there a realization in Israel that their isolation is growing?
Let's put some order and proportion. First of all, Israel did not lose Europe yet. The governments in Europe are very supportive to Israel, even after the last step they took last week. Israel still gains a lot of support, also in certain public opinions in Europe. Also, Islamophobia, which is becoming stronger and stronger in Europe, is playing in many ways into Israeli hands. So I wouldn't like to describe it as worse as it is. Yes, there are certain circles in the European public opinion who lost their patience toward the Israeli occupation, toward the Israeli violation of human rights and international law. But the governments are still way behind. Now, if there is a shift, and I hope there is a shift, then it might also get to the United States. But the United States seems to be still very, very far from the position of putting pressure on Israel. But one thing must be very clear. The key also in those negotiations that might start in the coming weeks, the key is in Washington, not in Ramallah and not in Tel Aviv. If there will be a devoted American president who wants to get to a solution, who wants to put an end to the Israeli occupation, he will find it very easy to do so by pushing Israel.
Well, so far, his Secretary of State, John Kerry, seems to have been pushing hard. He does have a tendency to be sometimes preemptively optimistic. But you're suggesting earlier it's what the EU has been saying about the West Bank and a kind of precursor to a boycott that's prompted Netanyahu to take these steps towards some kind of discussions that's going on that may hopefully last longer than the last ones that lasted for 3 days. My understanding is that, well, let me ask you this. Do you think that Netanyahu, we know that he's used Iran as a way to distract the issue. As long as he's talking about Iran, he doesn't have to talk about Palestine. But how much is that leverage over the Americans? In other words, in order to get Netanyahu not to attack Iran, the Americans have to compromise on Palestine. Is that in the works? Is that in the mix, do you think?
Listen, one might forget who is the superpower and who is the most depending country. It shouldn't be like this. You must know, and I guess you do know, that Israel is depending on the United States like never before, military, politically, and even economically. And I don't see why an American president cannot put pressure on Israel to put an end to the occupation, something that I have no doubt in my heart that President Obama believes in. Why can't he put an end to it once and for all without connecting it to anything, just to connect it to the friendship between Israel and the United States and to the dependence between Israel and the United States?
Well, again, I'm speaking with Gideon Levy, who is an Israeli journalist and columnist for Haaretz and a member of the newspaper's editorial board. He is the former spokesperson for Shimon Peres, and Gideon Levy writes the weekly Twilight Zone feature, which covers the Israeli occupation in the West Bank and Gaza for over the last 25 years. And his latest book is The Punishment of Gaza. So, assuming that the president does not seize that moment, as you've suggested, and, of course, it is unfortunately it's not likely, but you're suggesting here that if there is, in your article that's gotten a lot of international attention, you're suggesting that the Israeli economy will not withstand a boycott and that the analogy would be what happened in South Africa, where eventually the economic boycott became effective because the business community approached the country's leadership and basically says that this has got to end. So you're suggesting here that perhaps the Israeli business community would do the same and prevail on the more ideological politicians?
Absolutely. And not only the economical community, it can be also the army. It might also be the politicians by themselves. Look, Prime Minister Netanyahu is already well aware to the danger of international boycott. And this already brought him now to the negotiation table. I think this is one of his main concerns that brought him to this negotiation table, the fact that he understands that things are going to change and Europe might boycott more. So I can tell you more than this. The Minister of Justice, Tzipi Livni, the chief Israeli negotiator, she said it very clearly. She said last week, before the European step, that the European attitude is going to change very drastically. It will not include only boycott of settlement products, but it will include any Israeli product if Israel will not get back to the negotiation table.
Well, but they are back at the negotiating table. And are you suggesting that this is not necessarily sincere on Netanyahu's part? Is he dodging a bullet, or does he really seriously want to talk with the Palestinians?
It's a very good question that I'm not sure that anyone can give the answer. Until now, if to judge Netanyahu until now, he does not believe in peace with the Palestinians, he does not believe in the need of peace with Palestinians, and he has no intention to get to a real just settlement. His only purpose until now was to keep the strategic relations with the United States and to do anything possible in order not to lose sympathy in Washington. Did he change? Is he different in his third term? Let me doubt it very much, but we will have to give him to one more chance because there is no alternative. I'm very, 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 very skeptical. But what do we have to lose? Let's see.
Well, when you said, Gideon Levy, a little while ago that you wish the President of the United States would be more assertive and he has the power and the ability and he could make Israel be more serious, and many people have criticized U.S.-Israeli relations as they've been described as a form of assisted suicide in terms of the West Bank festering forever. And I guess a lot of the military people, they were the first, in fact, the military people, from my understanding, going back to people like Yehoshaphat Hakabi and others who brought about the idea of a two-state solution for security reasons primarily. But do you think that it would be helpful if the President of the United States isolated the people who you say in your article calling for a boycott, the Israeli Patriots' Final Refuge boycott, that you're saying that it's not the settlers who are the primary culprits, but rather those who cultivate their existence? And I assume you're referring to the Sheldon Adelsons and the Moskowitzes out here in California who have the Bicycle Club Casino and the family that owns Häagen-Dazs ice cream and others who send tons of money from the United States to Israel to build settlements on the West Bank. So do you think it would be useful in any way for the President to enter that debate and talk about the mechanics of how it's American conservative supporters of the Israeli right who are creating the facts on the ground?
No, this was not my intention, and I'm not sure the American President can prevent Sheldon Adelson, a private American citizen, from donating to any kind of purpose overseas. My main concern is that the settlement project is not a private project. It is a project of the State of Israel, and any Israeli is involved in this project. And I have very little complaints about the settlers. I have so many complaints about those who enabled them to be there, to steal the land, and to do what they are doing. So those must be punished or persuaded, those who carry the responsibility, namely the Israeli government and basically any Israeli citizen.
So I take it from your article that the problems go beyond politics. They're to do with, in many ways, with the attitudes of the Israeli people. You're suggesting in your article, as long as the arrogance and self-victimization continues amongst the chosen people, the most chosen in the world, always the only victim, the world's explicit stance won't change a thing. So I take it there are two problems that you have, that you feel the Israelis are too brainwashed with nationalism to come to their senses, and I guess to another extent, they're too comfortable living comfortable lives, which they just can't relate to what's happening quite near to them across the other side of the wall. So those are the two main factors that you're arguing. Am I correct?
Absolutely. I couldn't phrase it better.
And what kind of response have you gotten at home? It must make a lot of people uncomfortable.
You can imagine yourself, yes, but I'm quite used. Yeah, there are even two right-wing NGOs who want to sue me for this article because there is a new law in Israel which does not allow to call for boycott. I mean, this is already illegal according to the new law, just calling for boycotting Israel. So it might get to court, this article.
So, but presumably you're not a masochist, Gideon Levy. You're not out there to be punished. You're out there to try and change attitudes and change the politics. What about the Israeli left? Are they getting behind what you're sticking your neck out for?
Sure, there are certain circles, unfortunately very limited ones, who support such articles and encourage me to continue. But let's not be mistaken, we are dealing with a small minority.
And that you don't think there's any way you can change? Is that to do with the changing demographics, the emigration from Russia? What happened to the Israeli left? I know we don't want to spend the next hour talking about that, but can you give us a brief description or reason why it is that that the Israeli left is small and insignificant?
First of all, it was never really left and never really strong. It shrank. This is true after the Second Intifada, after the terror attacks, but it shows how little solid it was from the first place. And it has to do with many factors, but I think the biggest one is the systematic brainwash in Israel by the media, by the education system, which creates this attitude, very nationalistic and very blind morally.
Well, is there any note of optimism you can leave us on? I mean, every time we discuss Israel, it's usually bad news, and the headlines now are telling us that maybe there's some good news, or there's some reason to think that there may be some good news. I'm not wishing you to be Pollyanna here, but is there anything you can leave us with that is not bleak?
It's very hard for me, but let's give it a chance.
Okay. Well, Gideon Levy, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Gideon Levy, who is an Israeli journalist and columnist for Haaretz and a member of the newspaper's editorial board. He's the former spokesperson for Shimon Peres. Gideon Levy writes the weekly Twilight Zone feature in Haaretz, which covers the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza for over the last 25 years. And his latest book is The Punishment of Gaza. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.